Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today. Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 490.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm very excited to bring you a conversation with Dr. Vanessa Scaringi and Catherine Garland. They are two therapists specializing in eating disorders who together own Calm Counseling ATX in Austin, Texas. And in this conversation, we talked about a topic that's very much out there in the public discourse. You may have heard about it. I don't know if you'll know the term GLP-1s, but people are talking about Ozempic, Wegovy. Many celebrities and regular people are using these medications, which are originally diabetes medications, but people with and without diabetes are using them and having weight loss. So they're a bit controversial. And I wanted to know from eating disorder specialists what they thought. Are these medicines beneficial? Are they harmful? And what do therapists need to know? What do consumers need to know? And we had a really great conversation that went far beyond my very limited understanding about GLP-1s, what they do, who's using them and how, and what the potential cautions are. So if you've been hearing about GLP-1s and you are alarmed, concerned, curious, interested, hopeful, or you're using them yourself, you want to use them, I think that this conversation is really helpful for anyone in any of those situations. So before we get into our conversation, I wanted to mention that Therapy Chat is turning 10 years old in mid-August 2025, which is just a few weeks away right now as I'm recording this. And I've got a lot of exciting ideas for celebrating and new things happening that I want to tell you about. So for the therapists out there, those of you who are trauma therapists, and everyone who listens, you've been hearing me talk about Trauma Therapist Network and the membership. We just recently invited some new members into Trauma Therapist Network membership, which is wonderful. But for those of you who listen who aren't therapists, or maybe even if you are a therapist and you don't want or need the services that TTN provides, I wanted to let you know that we are going to be opening up another form of membership. It's been something that people have been asking for. Recently, when I was talking about hosting a webinar for people who might be interested in joining TTN, one longtime listener, Heath, said, "Would love an honorary member status, if but for a day." He said, "You're a tremendous asset to the community, the practice, and the digital voice ecosystem, Laura." Thank you, Heath. And while I'm not just tooting my horn here, I wanted to throw it out there that those who aren't therapists may want a place to talk about Therapy Chat too. and we're going to make that possible. So if you are interested in learning more about this, there's a link to a Google form in the show notes, and you could submit your information there. We will add you to a waiting list to let you know as soon as that membership is available, where you can get all the details and decide if it's something that you might want to do. So I'm looking for more ways to interact with those of you who listen. I find so much enjoyment in talking about the things that we talk about on Therapy Chat. And we don't always get to, well, we really never get to really unpack them. So what I have in mind is that we would meet in live calls to talk about Therapy Chat episodes and topics. And it's going to be kind of something that's going to develop based on the people who choose to join and what they want to talk about. But the link is in the show notes for just submitting your information. You're not even joining a list, an email list or anything, just submitting your information to let me know if you might be interested. And then you'll have an opportunity to join an email list if you want to, a waiting list for that. So thank you as always for listening. I can't wait to talk about the other giveaways and other fun celebrations that we're going to be doing for this big anniversary of 10 years of Therapy Chat. The same time, you know, we're getting close to 500 episodes. It always seems to come out this way. So there's a lot to celebrate here. And also Trauma Therapist Network is having its fourth anniversary in just a couple weeks. So I'm grateful to all of you who listen and made Therapy Chat what it is, and including all of the wonderful guests. And let's get into my conversation with Vanessa and Catherine about GLP-1s and eating disorders. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm very happy to be with Dr. Vanessa Scaringi and Catherine Garland of Calm Counseling ATX. Vanessa and Catherine, thank you so much for being my guests on Therapy Chat today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us,
yeah,
Laura.
I'm so excited. We've connected through Instagram, and now here we are together doing this. And I'm really eager to speak to you about your work with eating disorders and weaving in attachment with eating disorders. But specifically today, we're going to talk about a topic that a lot of people are thinking about and curious about and maybe have their own ideas about, but may not know that much about, like myself, which is GLP-1s and eating disorders and health. So before we get into that, let's start off by, if you would both take a moment to just tell our listeners a little more about who you are and what you do.
Yeah. Thanks again for having us. I'm Vanessa Scaringi. I'm a licensed psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist consultant. And I've been in the field for quite a while and started out doing some research and quickly pivoted to the clinical side. Much prefer it where I am now. Have worked at higher levels of care, and I'm currently in a private practice setting I co-own with Kate called Calm Counseling. And it gives us the benefit, it gives me the benefit of working with folks long-term, outpatient, where we can really kind of settle into understanding what is driving the behavior, primarily work with disordered eating. And that's a little bit about me.
Yeah. Vanessa and I have co-owned the practice for about a decade now. I started out, I'm a social worker, and I went to school in New York. And then in New York, it's very common to do analytic training after you graduate with a master's in social work. So I did that and kind of set the stage for a lot of my interest in attachment theory and these more psychodynamic practices in therapy. And then when I moved to Texas, I got a job working in an eating disorder higher level of care clinic, where I worked up until Vanessa and I met and went into practice together. So we both really share a desire to do kind of longer term relational work around eating disorders, have a passion for that, and really try to work from that lens in the practice.
Beautiful. That's how I feel too. I think that a lot of people, when they consider going to therapy, they're like, I have a problem, I need to go to therapy and make this problem go away. And they don't realize that you can do such deep beautiful exploration of who you are, why you are, how you are, what your soul's purpose is. Like, there's so much you can do in deep long-term therapy. You know, it doesn't have to be like long-term, but longer term, where it's not just about getting one symptom to go away. And I think especially with something like eating disorders, sure, we don't want people to have eating disorders, but there's so much complexity to what brings that behavior. And I think that there could be so much you can discover about yourself beyond only the symptom reduction.
Totally. We talk about that all the time.
Yeah. And we working in higher level of care, doing more cognitive behavioral therapy, doing values work, it's so important in that early treatment experience when you're working with people who have these really acute eating disorders that need immediate care and to be addressed. But our passion really is to work with people outpatient, being able to do that longer term work and deep dive that there just isn't always the time for in the treatment center because of insurance constraints. Unfortunately, that work will have to kind of get dealt with after being discharged from higher level of care. But there's so much root work that is so powerful in longer term recovery.
Yeah, and I just, Laura, to speak to what you were sharing, and disordered eating varies throughout the life cycle. And so the idea that, you know, you just kind of work on one symptom and then you're done really doesn't necessarily even work with disordered eating because it pops up in different ways at different portions of your life. And, you know, I think the benefit of being in outpatient care is we get to really explore all those stages. And I joke with Kate sometimes that I don't even feel like I work with eating disorders per se, because I talk so much about, you know, if someone's restricting with food, they're also restricting with other parts of their life. And we really focus more on that. And then inevitably, you know, flexibility builds with food and people. And so sometimes it doesn't even feel like we're working on a symptom per se.
And the attachment piece is so interwoven into what Vanessa's talking about, because through the lifespan, you know, we're having these different experiences of maybe meeting a partner or having children or going through hormonal changes in our body as we age, and how that can be so interconnected with behaviors coming up around those changes, and whether that's in your body or in your relationships with people.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I feel like before we get into talking about GLP-1s, I feel like it would be really valuable for our listeners if you could give a little bit of information about, you know, how you see attachment and eating disorders being connected. You know, it's not a small topic, but just a little, like, you know.
We can give you our elevator pitch for the importance of attachment and eating disorders. So, you know, attachment is really our keeping proximity to safety with our early caregivers. And then that kind of continues on throughout the lifespan in our relationships with people. So there's really, there's the gold standard, which is kind of the secure attachment pattern, which we use the word pattern rather than style, because we feel that it kind of gives more nuance. We can have different attachment relationships in different relationships that we have with people in our lives. So secure attachment, we're kind of always yearning for that and hoping for that. And if we're in a pretty regulated place in life, that's most typically what's coming up. And then there's the three insecure attachment patterns, which would be anxious, avoidant, and then more of what can be termed fearful, avoidant, or disorganized. So when you think about disordered eating, those behaviors are helping to regulate us, right? So if we are anxiously attached, we might be turning to food to seek comfort. If we're more avoidantly attached, we might be looking to food to kind of avoid pain and kind of get away from pain. And then in a fearful avoidant, that's kind of this mixture of the two, right? With a fearful avoidant attachment style, it's kind of characterized by, I want to have the attention and affection of my caregiver, but I also sometimes fear them. So you can just imagine how that happens with food, right? In our relationship with food, I desire food. I want to be comforted by it. But especially societally, food can feel very overwhelming and like it's dangerous for all sorts of reasons. So, you know, Vanessa and I look at these more primary attachments, but also the sort of sociocultural attachment to food and our bodies as well.
Can you say a little more about that sociocultural attachments?
Sure.
Well, I was just going to step in and name that. I think you said to food, and for sure that's a part of it. But just the world at large, I mean, this idea that, you know, to feel secure in an insecure world is really, it's hard, it's taxing, feels impossible sometimes. Yeah. And so the idea that, you know, we're always trying to find our footing and feel a little bit safer. But the world, I mean, we started out today just kind of talking casually about climate change and disasters that we're all experiencing. And it feels like every day there's something new that's really unsettling and fear, you know, we become fearful and scared. And so to feel safe and secure in a world that really isn't often can be really challenging. And so we talk a lot about how our eating can kind of ebb and flow when the insecurity is so profound.
And we have all these messages, right? Like, it's very confusing time. Messages that have big bucks behind them, whether that's the food industry that's kind of enticing us to purchase food to kind of soothe some of that attachment anxiety or the fear in the world. It can also be the wellness industry, which profits hugely off of selling us supplements or encouraging us to not eat certain foods, to follow this influencer and to do this certain what I eat in a day or these types of things. We're so flooded with these confusing, kind of sometimes mismatched perspectives on food and eating.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, I'm thinking of, I mentioned this before too, celebrity culture, like how the celebrities who are elevated in our culture, well, the people who get celebrity status in our culture, there's pretty strict definition of what one's body shape and size should be, and whether regardless of gender, because, you know, there's boxes for male and female presenting ideals. And yeah, it's so pervasive, the messages.
Yeah. And oh, I was going to say, there used to be so much more celebrity culture and so much, like, you know, there was so much distance, like, oh, you know, okay, Jennifer Aniston or whomever, that's clearly their job. This is what they do all day. And I, you know, that's different. But with social media and influencer culture, it's totally shifted. And, you know, it feels like that's just more than, you know, everyone's trying to achieve these things because it's, we're surrounded by it. And then influencer culture, you can actually, you know, make money off of being a sort of like homegrown celebrity, so to speak. And it's achievable for some. And anyway, that's obviously, I have feelings.
Yeah. I mean, social media kind of makes that, and like, I used the word ideal before, but it's like a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I can have followers, I could be an influencer, you know? And then, so yeah, I
think in the culture, like if we're looking at it through this lens of our attachment to greater society, it's clear that whether it is maybe a certain body type gets more amplified at a certain time, or if you're male or female, or there are, if you're non-binary, there are, you know, there's all kinds of ideals around body, right? But the message that we inherently get is a certain amount of thinness or fitness equals safety. And so if we're looking for safety culturally in our attachment to the world, we understand societally that that is what is expected of us. And if we don't meet that ideal, then we're falling short. And then we may be subject to discrimination or mistreatment or being devalued.
Really scary.
And that's really scary.
And the more precarious the world becomes, yeah, the more, you know, people are always going to be grabbing on to things that are going to make them feel safer or sturdier. And if there's, you know, value ascribed to body type, like, that's an easy, not, I'm not saying it's easy, but that's like the low hanging fruit of maybe I can try to fit in or feel some safety by manipulating my body.
So with all of that noise and influence from society about what we should be eating and how our bodies should look and the shapes of our bodies and the size of us, where do GLP-1s fit in with that? Everybody's talking about it, so we need to be talking about it.
I mean, they've been around for a long time. Just a quick answer to that very big question is a lot of safety and security seeking, you know, I think, in a nutshell. And just to name that, a lot of people are on GLP-1s for diabetes and managing other health markers. And they've obviously been researched more for that and are very useful. And there's also this whole class, this drug has this whole side of really wanting to take them to manage weight, strictly to manage weight. And there's new drugs to do that. So, I think Zepbound, they're going to be coming out more. So, people definitely want to be managing their weight in moments of being told, like Kate was saying, there's weight stigma and they're being told by doctors, your life's going to be cut short and all these different things. So managing weight, I mean, we don't take that lightly. It's very nuanced. So how they fit in is very gray, I would say. And we like the conversation because our client, like 13% of our clients are taking these drugs. And so I think as clinicians, we have to be prepared to have nuanced conversations and hold space for our clients potentially doing something without even telling us. Maybe they go to a doctor prescribes it, they start it. And then all of a sudden, we were never talking about food or weight, and now we are. And so I think it's just going to be, it's going to be entering into the therapeutic space a lot more. Like we're going to be talking more about bodies, comments about bodies. That's been coming up a lot when someone takes a new GLP-1 and they're on it for the first time. Now all of a sudden they're getting feedback about their bodies where they might not have. And so just, it brings up a lot. Obviously I feel flooded right now because I'm just like naming all the ways that I'm seeing it happen in my office.
Yeah. And I think like to add to Vanessa's point, there is this question of GLP-1s have been kind of sold to us, at least in terms of in the weight loss industry, as sort of this cure-all, right? This magic bullet that this is going to solve all of our problems. And it's really important to sort of ask, okay, well, cure for what, right? Because if it's cure for PCOS or diabetes, that's obviously a very different distinction than a cure for weight, because then it brings up the question of, do we need necessarily a cure for weight, or do we actually in large part need a cure for weight stigma? Which what we know as eating disorders is that weight stigma is really the origin of many eating disorders. And the danger with GLP-1s being sort of marketed as a cure for weight is that they actually may increase weight stigma. And a lot of our clients are experiencing that, especially ones that have had a history of an eating disorder where they're seeing much more content online, sort of before and after pictures and just, these triumphant stories of weight loss and how all of your issues are solved through this change in your body size, which again, as eating disorder therapists, oftentimes that's part of the story of someone with an eating disorder is that you lose a lot of weight, potentially, if that's the eating disorder that is coming up for you. And there is a feeling of euphoria. There is a feeling of this is, solving issues in my marriage or in interpersonal relationships, or I'm feeling good about myself. I feel less negative body image. And then through time that you really do start to uncover some of the deeper issues that maybe weren't so much about your body size, but were maybe a feeling of what is my value? What is my what is the meaning in my relationships with people? How do people perceive me? And a lot of those issues are not cured through weight loss attempts. And so that's not to say that people can't have positive outcomes related to increasing their health. But when we make that emphasis so much about weight, there is kind of a danger in that because it does increase this idea that our value is wrapped up in our appearance, which as we know as therapists is just not the case.
Exactly. It's so objectifying too. And in our culture, I think with the way it is now, there is a lot of objectification of everyone. Everyone is like a category, you are this, and that's all you are, the way that kind of the big picture culture looks at people, but
people as product is kind of a danger. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Commodity. It's like, what can you do? That's your value. So if you're in a female presenting body, it's, as a sexual object or a childbearing object, mm-hmm. And then there's this piece where the medical system has kind of a fixation about weight, the health at every size mm-hmm. has not reached the medical world. They're like,
they haven't gotten
you have a headache, lose weight. You're depressed, lose weight. You have trauma, lose weight. You have this, lose weight, you know?
Yeah. And now
it's reductive.
And now there's also a way to not just put someone on a diet, put someone on a medication that, I mean, they have a lot of outcomes, good outcomes, quote unquote good, in the sense that people lose a lot of weight. And so physicians are prescribing them a lot. And but something you were saying earlier made me think about that reductionist part of, you know, not everyone can tolerate. A lot of people get off of GLP-1s. And so when you totally buy into this idea that like a GLP-1 is going to fix something that's going on, you're sidestepping a lot of potential work to be done, you know? And then if you can't tolerate the drug and you have to get off of it or your insurance cuts it off, you're sort of left in the same spot and not really addressing the underlying issues.
And I do, like, I think Vanessa and I, sometimes we get concerned about being too, almost like coming across as like anti-science or, you know, too puritanical about things. And so I feel like it's important to underscore that we have clients who are taking GLP-1s, and in that work, we're trying to kind of slow down and look at all of these issues. And some people are feeling positive impacts from taking these medications. In some ways, similarly to without the weight stigma piece, taking an antidepressant or taking a medication that's sort of fueling your ability to have clarity and do deeper work in therapy. And so I think there is this, like, you know, I feel it shifting, that there's more nuance that's being entertained in these spheres therapeutically, and not wanting to condemn or, you know, have, it's not a one size fits all. Like we are all unique people, and we're coming to these decisions with a lot of forethought and trying to weigh all the pros and cons. And so just, I want to like slide that in there, as I think we try to really leave a lot of room for the many different reasons why people make these decisions about their bodies and about their health.
There's so much talk about women's hormonal health, but most women are left even more confused about what it means for them and what to do about it. This confusion ends now. Hormone Harmony is a game changer for women struggling with hormonal imbalances that leave them exhausted both physically and mentally. It only contains science-based ingredients that bring back comfort, energy, clarity, confidence, and a sense of balance. Happy Mammoth, the company behind this phenomenal formula, has helped over 2.4 million women get their lives back and feel like themselves again after years or even decades of hormonal imbalances. What makes this formula unlike anything else on the market is that it tackles multiple hormonal imbalances at the same time, creating a cascade of benefits all throughout the body and mind, leading to better mood, more energy, and deep comfort. The reviews are unbelievable. Over 50,000 women are raving about better energy, deeper sleep, feeling more balanced and calm, reduced bloating, and more. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code chat at checkout. Today's episode is sponsored by Psychotherapy Networker and PESI. If you're a therapist, be sure to check out the partner page, which is linked in the show notes, where you can get discounted trainings with previous Therapy Chat guests like Courtney Armstrong, Dr. Leslie Korn, Dr. Ariel Schwartz, Dr. Tammy Nelson, Dr. Janina Fisher, Rebecca Case, Dr. Peter Levine, Dr. Lindsay Gibson, Deb Dana, Lori Gottlieb, and many, many others. You'll find the link in the show notes to my partner page with PESI and Psychotherapy Networker, where you can find all these discounted training. If you need CEs, this is a great place to go. We all know how hard it can be to eat healthy without feeling like we're giving up flavor or fun. Washington Red Raspberries are a clean, simple, and seriously delicious way to add more nutrition to your day. They're American grown, picked at peak ripeness, and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients like fiber, antioxidants, and vitamin C. And they have no added sugar, just fruit as nature intended. And the best part, they're being harvested and frozen right now by family farms in Washington State. So when you buy American-grown frozen raspberries, you're getting fresh off the field flavor all year long. I like using frozen American red raspberries in my smoothies. They taste fresh, juicy, and full of flavor because they're grown in nutrient-rich soil and frozen at peak ripeness. Whether you're trying to clean up your snacks or build better meals, these berries are a total win. Want to discover new ways to use American frozen red raspberries and get more details on where you can grab a bag? Go to redras.org. redraz.org. That's redraz.org. Next time you're at Costco, Kroger, Meijer, or Winco Foods, make sure to check out products made with Washington red raspberries and be sure to look for product of the U.S. on the bag. Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from clients' secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today. Yeah, and of course, there are, in eating disorders, there are many different types of eating disorders. And, you know, it's not only about restricting. Those are the ones that I think most people associate with eating disorders as we think about like anorexia or binging and purging. But I can see that you have a nuanced understanding of these medicines having some positive effects for some people. It's more maybe what we're talking about is like what therapists should know in order to support clients who are considering GLP-1s or are taking them or what would you want people to consider? So for therapists who are listening or people who are listening who are considering taking these medicines. So huge question. What are some things that are important to understand about these medications?
Yeah, I think Kate said, you know, slowing the process down. And to me, that's just so important to really have a sense of what's really motivating the decision. What's someone hoping for? You know, you get to talk about all the fantasies that might come and just being able to have frank conversations about, you know, what's going to happen if your dad at Thanksgiving says something totally inappropriate about your body size. And, you know, just getting a chance to really like understand that, you know, there's a focal point that can be uncomfortable or that it might shut off some food, you know, food noise, and that might feel really relieving. And how can we still understand what might be underlying some of the messaging that that food noise might have historically shared with you? Maybe it's been actually telling you something about a relationship or your attachment. Maybe there's something to be exploring. And is the medication then going to, you know, to redirect us or sort of reroute us? So being able to slow down can give us the chance to really understand the motivation, the goals, and then also really understand, like, sometimes there's a way that these medications can maybe mute some experiences. People talk about feeling a little bit more muted, maybe that there's not as much like impulsivity, but also there's not as much, you know, potential joy in certain experiences, like food, like eating can become a little bit more mechanical. You might have to force, you know, just kind of force yourself to eat because the signals are just not going off. And so really trying to slow it down and understand, like, what's that going to be like if you're having to eat mechanically in front of your kids? Are you going to explain that you're on a GLP-1? I mean, it's just it can be such a far-reaching experience to start a medication like this. And I don't even think people realize sometimes. They're like, oh, my doctor prescribed it. Oh, I'm going to take it. And then all of a sudden, there's a lot of backlash. Not like people offering backlash, but just emotionally, there might be some other things happening.
It can be confusing because, as you were saying, Laura, you know, not every eating disorder is a restrictive one, but oftentimes, more often than not, there is restriction in binge eating, and that's part of the cycle of binge eating. And even with bulimia, there are many episodes typically for people where their restriction is part of their eating disorder. So if you're taking a medication that all of a sudden is allowing for you to not have the food noise or the desire for food, that is an emotional experience. We know these drugs impact our brain and our gut. So that you are having some influence that is kind of interrupting what typically would be happening in your brain and in your response to food, your feelings about food. And I just think it can be so useful to go down the therapeutic route of being very curious about that. Like Vanessa's saying, you know, are you noticing that, you know, maybe your partner is saying, hey, like you know, we haven't been spending as much time together, or like you may be noticing, like, I'm actually feeling a little bit more avoidant in my relationships with people, possibly, right? It could be the opposite. People describe, I have more room for my relationships with people because I'm thinking so much less about food. And then, you know, another thing that seems like it's kind of not completely sussed out is dosage of these medications, yeah. Right? So having some language around that and being able to talk to your doctor or talk to your therapist about, I'm noticing these changes that are happening interpersonally that I didn't anticipate, or I want to do some exploration around, why is that coming up? Why is that shifted for me?
Yeah, this is interesting to me. So being not in the, I'm not an eating disorder specialist, and I am pretty ignorant about these medications, really. So I'm very grateful for your educating me, but, and everyone who's listening, but are you saying that the medications have a mood effect? Like, is it doing a mood effect in terms of like,
so we're not doctors, we're not even scientists, but we are speculating
anecdotally,
yes, that appetite, right, our hunger and fullness cues have all kinds of hormones, the gut microbiome is involved. There are all these different processes that Vanessa and I, is way over our heads, that interact with our relationship with how hungry we are when we're seeing foods and smelling foods and interacting with food. And so what we know about the medication is that it does have an effect on those hormones and on the gut-brain connection. So, you know, this is fascinating when it comes to thinking about interoception and neurobiology,
right,
and just all of these components that we're kind of like playing around with, and they could potentially have mood effects, because what we know is that we've been, for since the dawn of man, probably using food on some level to help regulate our mood if we were lucky enough to do so, or if there was, you know, enough time to have.
And
that
the absence
happen
of food affects our mood, like
that's right, yeah,
we're hangry, right? Like I get hangry all the time. But I also,
blood sugar, yeah, for me, I get hypoglycemic. Yeah. So yep, I'm yep, not diabetic, but I do, if I go too long without food, or I haven't had enough like fiber to sustain what I ate, then, and enough protein, I guess, then I'll be just like, oh, just have this frantic feeling.
Right. Yeah.
Frantic. But I'm not using the food to make me not feel frantic, but without it, right, I do.
Yeah.
It has an impact. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, people, well, they'll just, if they're on a on a GLP-1, they sort of have to experiment. Like, can I offset any of that experience with mechanically eating? You know, they might have to become more intentional, because it inevitably is going to affect your mood if you're just not eating, if the medication is just suppressing your appetite. And that would be a moment to really like, okay, I got to talk to my doctor about this. This isn't going to work. And so
we still need nourishment no matter what.
Yes, absolutely. And anecdotally, I have had a few clients who have had to really bring up the dosing to their physicians, because the first dose didn't, it just made them kind of feel like off and not themselves and lower. And dosing has sometimes helped with that, and changing medications. It's kind of like antidepressants, where someone starts a new any kind of psychotropic medication, and they have to really kind of tinker and meet with a physician who's really willing to explore some of that. And so I think all of this is to say that having these open conversations and not expecting the drug to just be a cure-all is really helpful along the way.
Yeah. You're bringing up things that I haven't thought about at all, but there are some things. Well, there's two things I need to ask you, because not being an eating disorder specialist, and I'm assuming other people who are listening may not know these terms either, but can you explain what food noise and mechanically eating are?
Yeah, totally.
I can guess, but I just figured you'll have a better explanation.
Well, food noise is something that I think has gotten a lot of attention recently. and has been kind of sold to us as like, oh, this bad, you shouldn't have any extra chatter in your head about what you're eating and when, which, you know, that might look like, oh, I'm about to sit down to a meal and all of a sudden I'm flooded with like, I shouldn't eat this. I feel this way about this food. This is going to make me, my body look a certain way. All of that, you know, might factor into someone's choices at mealtime. It might factor into when they're sitting down or even the guilt they might feel or feelings they might feel after they're eating. And so the attention that food noise has gotten lately is like, let's just exterminate it, eradicate it. This is bad. It shouldn't be there. And as clinicians, I mean, we've historically just really wanted to understand that information because it gives us so much understanding of what's really happening when you're eating. Like, what are you? Whose voice is that in your head? You know, we get to really explore all these things with clients. So the idea of just eradicating it is like, whoa, I don't think you can do that. I mean, some people are experiencing that with some GLP-1s, but anyway, that's food noise. Kate, can you share a little bit more if I'm missing things? And then mechanical eating is, yeah, what you were probably assuming. Intuitive eating is kind of the gold standard, listening to your body, having that really drive and dictate what you're eating and when you're eating. And mechanical is like, I'm going to wake up at 9, I'm going to eat at 9:30. And no matter what I'm eating, you know, a bar and whatever, something else. So
my body needs to be fed. Like, that can be an experience of like, you know, sometimes if you just had a baby or, you know, you're like, things are thrown off, right? That there's something that's kind of disconnecting you to your hunger cues, that you still know my body needs to be fed. So I'm going to put something into my system, even though my appetite is not really indicating that for me. And we deal with this a lot with, you know, anyone who's taking a stimulant has ADHD, you know, sometimes kids in the morning, it's like they take the stimulant and then they're not really hungry, but it's like, okay, we got to get something in you because you're going to need it. Your brain needs it. Your body needs it to make it through the day. But the one point I did want to add to Vanessa talking about food noise is that I think, and this might be like way extraneous information that everyone, you know, could elicit some yawns from people who don't care that much about it. But the sort of medical model understanding of GLP-1s for weight loss is kind of viewed through the lens of food as a substance addiction, potentially. I'm not going to say this like firm stance for everyone, but there is this sort of messaging of, we have a problematic food industry, we have ultra processed foods that people become addicted to, and then that problem needs to be mitigated by, which creates a lot of food noise because we are just like ravenous for these substances.
Can't control, you know, quote unquote, control yourself.
Right. And so then the eating disorder world kind of is wary of seeing food as a substance addiction. Maybe there could be some behavioral addiction, which is more like gambling, shopping, kind of these things that aren't a substance that we would be addicted to, like caffeine or drugs or alcohol, because food is something that we need for life, right? That we can't really... We can't be abstinent from food, or that we have another problem on our hands. So we really see it through the lens of, it's hard to just do a big, huge swath of food noise as this thing that is just about being addicted to food, because what if food noise is also hunger for connection or fear, or, you know, there are all kinds of things. This idea that it's not just like one thing, right? We're human. We have all these interconnected systems, and our felt sense is very much a part of our relationship with food and eating.
So last thing before we have to stop is, if you could just talk about, and I mean, you've touched on it, but just maybe expand a little bit about on the topic of intuitive eating, and then how GLP-1s may create barriers or challenges in that regard?
Absolutely. I mean, I sort of want to answer your question with a little bit of an anecdote that I've had clients who also express that it's helped them pursue some intuitive eating. Part of that is the reduction in some food noise, and part of it is just like the overwhelming guilt that was associated with certain foods. So it's allowed some space to have foods like, you know, we use these terms really inner fear foods, you know, that's kind of a food that someone historically has maybe binged on or has felt a lot of shame or guilt around eating, but maybe being on a GLP-1 has allowed them to have that in their home because they can feel a little bit safer that they won't engage in that kind of behavior with it. So I have had folks have that experience.
Okay.
But ultimately, I think overarching theme is that it takes away the ability to eat intuitively because you're not able to access your hunger and fullness in the just that's kind of what they're meant for, is that they're really cutting off our hunger cues so that you don't consume as much, you know, in obviously we're not dietitians, but you don't consume as much. So that makes it really hard to gain access to what it is you're hungry for, what would satisfy you. And it might lead to more of the need to eat mechanically. So it can interrupt that process.
That's where it's one of the red flags for me about this is if, and I'm not a physician or a researcher either, but if it disconnects us from our hunger and fullness cues, which are part of our biological like system, how we're designed, you know, is it taking us out of our body in some way? And, you know, and how beneficial is that? And I guess it's the question, it's more of a rhetorical question, because what you're pointing out is that there are many nuances. It's really individual to each person. What is the safest and healthiest approach for them based on, you know, their body, their history, their biology, and what they're struggling with. But that, to me, that's a red flag. Like for me, that just feels off. Like if it makes me not be able to feel the way my body's supposed to be responding naturally, that
I totally hear that. And I think, like, you know, we turn this over and turn this over to kind of figure out how we feel about it. It's so new, you know, we're all kind of, it's this very like,
and you know way more about it than me. I was just giving my opinion.
No, I think that that's a lot of people feel that way. Right. And then I think what we're going to have to move toward is intention, right? That like, if the intention is weight loss, that is this just for the sake of thinness, the pursuit of thinness, right? That might be very different than someone who is really feeling like, you know, my issue is that I'm binge eating. And this has given me pause to be able to explore that issue, unpack, you know, what my relationship with food is. In some ways, one could attribute that. It's like saying if I am depressed and I take an antidepressant and my expectation for myself is I have to be the most charismatic, the best, you know, like have the best life ever to be, you know, living up to this external expectation versus I just want to get in touch with who I am. And it's very hard for me to do that in this sort of midst of a depressive episode. I do think we're going to have to become more like curious about people's intentions and what they're looking for. And that's not to say that everybody has, there are some people who, you know, want to take a GLP-1 to lose weight and to be thin. And, you know, it's not a criminal
act.
Body. Right. Yeah. Like you can do that.
There's worse things to do for sure.
Absolutely. But I think if you are interested in getting more, as you're talking about, you know, the tuning fork of like, who am I? What is bringing me a sense of internal regulation and harmony and feeling like I can have access to being close to other people and, you know, living life in a way that feels like in line with my values. Let's do that work. Let's explore like what can be helpful in that work and what, you know, how that looks for each individual is not really for us to dictate, but to just be curious about.
I love that perspective. I really appreciate that. Cause obviously I am thinking about it in a more, again, like black and white kind of way too.
It's scary.
I don't know there's that much danger. About it. Yeah.
It's scary. Yeah. And there's a danger in it of just, you know, not
just cutting off. Like you're doing this with your hand. And I keep thinking you're just cutting off the hunger. Potentially you're cutting off the food noise. You're not letting there be space to explore these things that are really important and really worth exploring.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation and very thought provoking. I'm grateful to you for kind of opening up my perspective about, you know, just not dismissing these medications wholesale as being harmful or contributing to weight stigma alone, even though that is a piece of what's going on.
It's a piece.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, and it's good to know that when working with people who are dealing with eating disorders, that you can be really nuanced and really have a wise perspective about the whole all the questions and just kind of curious rather than jumping to any conclusions like I was doing. So hopefully you help me jump to less conclusions as well from this conversation.
Thanks for this conversation. It was really enriching for us too.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad that you both spent time with me here. And where can people find all the wonderful things that y'all are doing?
This is where we really look like geriatric millennials because we have a hard time with this.
MySpace?
Yeah. We are on Instagram as Calm Counseling PLLC, I think. Nope.
Calm Counseling ATX.
Yeah, I can confirm it's ATX. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then our web address is keepcalmatx.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, again, thank you so much for spending some time with me and educating me and our listeners on how these medications are showing up in your practices. And thanks for what you're doing, really making a difference in the world. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.